thousand of England's junior doctors. What is different this time? They're joined by 20,000 of their senior counterparts for the first time, all asking to be paid what they deserve.
We do this with a heavy heart, but our salaries have been falling in real terms for 14 years. My salary in real terms is 35% lower than it was 14 years ago. Unfortunately, the Prime Minister refuses to talk with doctors about pay, and so have been forced to do this.
Junior doctors are asking for a 35% restoration, while their senior counterparts are asking for an above-inflation pay rise. In July, Prime Minister Rishi Sunak said there would be no more negotiations on pay and that the rise recommended by the so-called independent pay review body was final. Yet this, the doctors say, isn't just about pay. It's about the depressing state of the NHS. Junior doctor Arjun Singh fears for its future.
If you're having people waiting 12 hours in waiting rooms before they're seen by a doctor, if you're having people having heart attacks and strokes in A&E waiting rooms before they're seen, well, that is a system that has collapsed. And the reason that it has collapsed is in large part because we've not funded our workforce properly. We can't retain doctors. You can't have a hospital and an NHS if your doctors are leaving so frequently.
According to the British Medical Journal, 4 in 10 junior doctors in the UK plan to leave the NHS as soon as they can find another job, at home or abroad. But while the trench warfare continues, delayed appointments have reached the 1 million mark, with the NHS's waiting list already at an estimated 7.6 million.
If the government has any hope of these doctors giving up their industrial action anytime soon, then today's double doctor strike should be a sign that that is simply not going to happen.
With both sides digging in their heels, the strikes could continue into another crippling winter. And for patients on the long waiting list, that could potentially mean months of more misery. Saeed Purza, London.
Palestinians keep descending further into poverty and de-development under the Israeli occupation. In a report released on Monday, the World Bank said poverty rates are stubbornly high, as roughly one out of four Palestinians live below the poverty line. Palestinian non-governmental organizations say the poverty is more severe in Gaza.
In Gaza, the situation is more and more catastrophic comparing to the West Bank due to the blockade and wars for the 16 years. We have high deterioration on the humanitarian conditions, also on the economic standards. Due to this blockade, we have food insecurity.
They say that the Israeli occupation and blockade are the main culprits behind the increase in poverty among Palestinians. The Abu Ajwa family in Gaza's Zaytun neighborhood, where more than a dozen people reside, their average daily income is only around $5 a day. The abject poverty has forced them to live in miserable conditions.
Look at my house. It is falling apart and we can't afford to fix it. You can't even imagine how hard it is for me or for my family. Our living conditions and those of many families here are disastrous. We can hardly afford to put food on the table. Poverty has taken its toll on us, and I don't see any improvement to our situation anytime soon.
The situation of the Abu Ajwa family is just a small example of how thousands of people live in the tiny territory. Most Gazans are impoverished and rely on handouts to survive as their incomes continue to dwindle. More than 2 million Palestinians in the Gaza Strip have been living under intensified access restrictions since 2007 and are largely isolated from the outside world.
The people who are in need for humanitarian assistance, 80% of the population, and most of them children, women, elders, who are in bad need for such assistance on time, we are suffering from shortage of funding for humanitarian aid. This will lead for more deterioration in the humanitarian and socio-economic situation.
Daily life is a constant struggle for most Gazans because of the inhumane Israeli practices.
According to experts, the Israeli regime is responsible for the high poverty rate and the near collapse of Palestine's economy, as well as its isolation from the rest of the world. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
According to the EU's own official data, 74% of small and medium-sized businesses within the 27-country bloc cannot find skilled workers. At the same time, millions of young people are unemployed. EU Youth Affairs Ministers met on Monday and Tuesday to discuss the crisis.
I think it's very obvious that we have a generation of young people who have been living through crisis after crisis since 2008. The financial crisis, the COVID pandemic, and now they're going through the consequences of a war at the heart of Europe.
The neglect of young adults in the EU was acknowledged last week in the European Parliament.
8 million young people are neither in employment, nor in education, nor in training. 8 million. Their dreams put on hold, their lives on standby.
Youth ministers have agreed to coordinate efforts across the EU to try and fix broken education systems.
One in every six Europeans has mental health problems. Not just young people, but also older people connected to loneliness and isolation. For example, every European with mental health issues has a right to access help mechanisms.
It's a right, but experts say help is often unavailable. Apparently, there's a need to prioritise funding.
We have debts and deficits, so the challenge really is how to reconcile this continuous pressure on public budgets, which health is placing, with the broader macroeconomic context.
It is being suggested that allowing young people to fall through the cracks while focusing all resources on the war in Ukraine threatens the future of the entire EU project. According to campaign groups advocating for the rights of young people, the inability of the political establishment in the EU to bring about job opportunities is translating into growing support for extreme anti-EU political parties. It's thought this disquiet will become clearly evident in 9 months from now, when a record number of Eurosceptic candidates are forecast to be successful during European Parliament elections. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
After years of negotiations, the European Commission has finally taken a position on the migrant issue, the harshest one. Brussels will in fact back the Italian far-right government's hardline stance on migration. Italy's Prime Minister Giorgia Meloni has welcomed a 10-point plan on migrants presented by European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen in Lampedusa on Sunday.
I'm confident the issue of migration will be added to the agenda of the next EU summit in October. We must stop departures from Africa and swiftly deport those turned down for asylum. The future of Europe is at stake here.
Following a surge in migrant arrivals on Italy's shores, von der Leyen visited the southern island of Lampedusa on Sunday, where the situation has been tense since the start of the year, with thousands of migrants stranded in difficult conditions. Here, von der Leyen announced a new migrant action plan, which includes fighting trafficking, returning migrants to the countries of origin, and transferring migrants from Italy to other EU member states.
It is very important for me because irregular migration is a European challenge and it needs a European answer. So we are in this together.
Germany has promptly expressed its support for another proposal made by the European Commission President von der Leyen that concerns expanding air and naval surveillance of the European Union's external borders. Some experts are of the idea that such a measure would be against international maritime law, as EU ships would not be allowed to operate in territorial zones where only North African states have jurisdiction.
Air and naval surveillance of the Mediterranean by the EU would be equivalent to a warlike act. We all know what has happened to Libya after the French-led NATO attack there. All migrants' countries of origin must be involved in a more democratic process of handling the migrants. Also, von der Leyen's 10-point plan on migrants is full of inconsistencies.
Meanwhile, French Interior Minister Gérald Darmanin made a lightning visit to Italy on Monday. In an interview to a French radio, Darmanin said that France is willing to help Italy to secure its borders, but it will not take in any migrants from the island of Lampedusa. Max Civili, Rome.
Sports is one of the fields that has made significant progress after the victory of the Islamic Revolution in Iran, and today Iranian athletes shine in different international competitions. In terms of the number of medals, the 2012 Olympics in London was unprecedented for Iranians after the victory of the Islamic Revolution. Iran left London with a total of 13 medals, 7 gold, 5 silver and 1 bronze, finishing 12th in the overall medal standings. But undoubtedly, Iran's national wrestling team has always brought colorful medals back home. And now, as the World Wrestling Championships is underway in Belgrade, Iran has already won 1 gold medal in the freestyle category. Greco-Roman wrestlers are well prepared for the World Championships as well as the Asian Games due in China's Hangzhou City.
We are very much prepared for the Belgrade World Championships. All the teammates are at the peak of their preparedness. After the Belgrade Championships, we have the Asian Games in Hangzhou ahead. I'm very much motivated and hopeful.
I've been a member of the national team for about 8 years now. I have a number of world and Asian medals. I'm quite ready for the Belgrade competitions.
Our Greco-Roman wrestling team is at its utmost readiness for the World Championship in Belgrade. The Belgrade event is of great importance because the medalists will be given the ticket for the Olympic Games. We are very much hopeful about winning medals.
Iranian athletes and especially wrestlers practice hard to get prepared for securing top places at global competitions, despite all the limitations which are imposed against Iran and Iranian national teams.
Also at junior level, Iran's national wrestling team has a good record to the extent that back in early August 2023, Iran's national junior Greco-Roman wrestling team ranked first in World Championships in Istanbul, winning 1 gold, 1 silver and 2 bronze medals. Salman Kujuri, Tehran.
One month after reaching a deal mediated by Qatar, the U.S. and Iran each released 5 prisoners sought by the other. The 5 U.S. detainees left Tehran aboard a Qatari plane for Doha, en route to their country. All were arrested on charges of espionage and collaborating with foreign governments. The U.S. citizens freed include Siam Aknamazi, Emma Charghi, and Murad Tahbaz. The identities of the other 2 have not been disclosed. The 5 Iranian prisoners were identified as Mehrdad Moin Ansari, Kambiz Attar Kashani, Reza Sarhangpur Kofrani, Amin Hassanzadeh, and Kaveh Lutfullah Afrasiabi. They were held in American jails illegally under the pretext of violating U.S. sanctions.
After a successful teamwork, 5 innocent Iranians held in U.S. prisons were freed today. 2 of them are on the way to Tehran via Doha. Iran's Human Rights Council is determined to uphold the rights of Iranian nationals abroad in cooperation with the executive and judiciary powers.
Tehran has repeatedly urged Washington to release innocent Iranian nationals who have been taken hostage on baseless charges of bypassing U.S. sanctions, decrying Washington for tying the humanitarian issue with other issues, including the revival of the 2015 nuclear deal.
I mean, this is a type of blackmailing, you know, this is kind of like mafia work, but within a government, and this is what the U.S. does, right? They arrest people, they put, unjust charges, they fabricate charges. And this is their way of trying to bully the Islamic Republic of Iran and weaken them. But the Islamic Republic of Iran, thankfully with their leadership and the supreme leader, they're not giving in and they're not bowing down and they're not being submissive and they're fighting for their rights.
A few minutes after the release of the prisoners, U.S. President Joe Biden slapped fresh sanctions on Iran, sending a message of continued enmity towards the Islamic Republic. The sanctions on Iran's intelligence ministry and former President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad were imposed over the alleged disappearance of Bob Levinson, a former FBI agent. Levinson reportedly visited Iran's southern Kish Island on March 2007. He later went missing and his whereabouts have remained unknown ever since. Tehran and Washington have many unresolved issues which lay barriers in their ties, such as the heavy unilateral sanctions imposed unjustly by the U.S. Iran has time and again expressed readiness to put aside differences and resolve issues via diplomatic ways, such as this case.
The
The health ministry in Gaza Strip says that the lives of hundreds of kidney failure patients are at risk due to lack of medicine and special chemicals needed for dialysis machines. Most kidney patients are hospitalized in the territory's biggest medical center, the Shifa Hospital. The hospital, just like other health facilities in Gaza, has been struggling with severe shortage of basic supplies for several years under the Israeli blockade. This has hit the patients with chronic diseases, including renal failure, the hardest, and children are no exception.
Kidney failure patients in Gaza Strip are amounting to 1,100. These patients, usually every one of them will make dialysis 3 times per week in different hospitals of Gaza Strip. Among those 1,100, we have 38 children. So without having those dialysis every week 3 times, they will certainly succumb to their life and they will die.
The lives of kidney failure patients depend on dialysis machines, but they usually malfunction due to overuse and lack of spare parts for repairs.
I need kidney dialysis 3 times a week, and I suffer from various illnesses. Dozens of medicines are nowhere to be found in Gaza's hospitals. The situation is very dangerous, and not having the treatment is a death sentence to kidney patients.
Death and suffering for Palestinians have always been what has come out of Israel's policy of keeping almost every necessity under scarcity in the Gaza Strip. And the health system has been no exception.
Today, this crisis is very acute now. I think this is the top urgent crisis we're facing in Gaza Strip today. And as you know, every now and then, the Israelis are still waving to attack Gaza once again. So the situation is very hard, complicated. And humanitarian issues, including health sector, should be avoided from all those punishment to the Palestinian people because the patients will pay their lives.
What makes things worse for Palestinians is the fact that the international community remain apathetic to their plight.
Gazans have been facing difficulties in receiving medical care since 2007. The Ministry of Health blames the Israeli blockade for the endless suffering, especially among chronically ill patients. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio. With you every single moment.
Supplication on Saturdays. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Bismillah, words that seekers of sanctuary repeatedly recite. Words that the very cautious in search of protection often repeat. I seek refuge with Allah, the Exalted above all. From the oppression of the unjust, from the deceitful malice the envious use to lay snares and traps, from the injustice and outrage of the tyrants, and I sing his praise. Do better and go beyond other praisers. O Allah, thou art one, has no partner, and is the Lord and Master without being made. There is no discrepancy or nonsense in thy commands, nor there is lawlessness in thy kingdom. I beseech thee to send blessings on Muhammad, thy servant, thy messenger. To let me ask thee for enlightenment and inspiration, so as to be thankful for thy bounties, which alone get thy approval ultimately. To help me to obey thee and instinctively worship thee, and make me deserve thy rewards on account of thy very patronage. And have mercy on me, and prevent me from breaking in the bounds of thy prohibitions, as far as I am kept alive, and show the way unto that which is useful and advantageous till I go on survive. To let me take to heart the meanings of thy book, and by its reading, throw down the heavy burden of sins, and receive welfare and salvation as a gift. Let not my family and friends who love me leave me alone. Let thy favors reach me in abundance during the remainder of my life, exactly as they used to be made available for me in full in the days gone by. Oh, the most merciful.
Sound from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Yemen is marking the 9th anniversary of the September 21 revolution. In 2014, the people of Yemen led a popular uprising against the Saudi-backed unpopular regime of Abd Rabbah Mansur Hadi. In the meantime, Yemen has endured the worst Saudi onslaught backed by the U.S. on the country, a war which has temporarily stopped, but not over yet, due to ongoing talks with the Saudi side. Will this revolution bear the fruits of the hardships that the people in Yemen endured? Will outside interference, like from the U.S., prevent this from happening? Ultimately, will there be a peace deal? Just a few of the angles we'll be looking at in this edition of the program. First, let me introduce our guest. Hussein Al-Bukhaiti, activist and political commentator, joins us from Sana'a. Also joining us is Saab Shah, author and West Asia expert, who joins us from Belfast. Welcome to you both. I'll start with you, Hussein Al-Bukhaiti. So it's been a long time now, taking a look back at what has happened here. One of the things that I'd like to get your idea on was back in 2012, if I may test your memory, you had elections that happened there, and you had people that came out to vote. But the problem was that this was a one-man election. You only had, and it's quite incredible, Abd Rabbah Mansur Hadi as the only candidate that came out. And, of course, we know if there's one candidate, who's going to win. I think the people of Yemen obviously must have lost trust, if there was any left, in that process. Can you tell us what your thoughts were, given what happened back then?
Yeah, that's exactly what happened. This actually was made up by the Saudi, the so-called the Gulf Initiative, which has insisted that Yemenis must have that national dialogue. And then there was that election because Abd Rabbah Mansur Hadi, his term has ended at that time. So they said they will extend his term for 1 year. And Ansarullah have actually agreed to that at that time. But after this year was ended, they have done as you say, one-man election. And he actually, obviously, has won that election. And they show you that what the Saudi actually claim that they are protecting the so-called Yemeni legitimacy is all lies. And we know now that Saudi Arabia has actually put the former President Hadi under house arrest for almost 1 year and a half or 2 years. We don't know what's happening with him. That's actually a clear message to everybody, especially people in Yemen who are fighting in the side of Saudi Arabia and United Arab Emirates. They must they must know that Saudi and United Arab Emirates actually they just want Yemen to be divided, and they just want the situation to get worse in Yemen. But on the other side, they want as well to have peace, not only in Yemen, but to avoid any attack or any ballistic missiles or drone attack against Saudi Arabia and United Arab Emirates.
All right, so you had, Sabshath, the elections, and then you had Yemen's Ansarullah that moved in and took over the state institution in Sana'a and basically wanted to have a democratically elected institution overall to be there. But then you had the war that broke out. Tell us the reason why you had Saudi Arabia, which led a coalition at that point, backed by the United States, leading this war. What reasons did they have behind doing that?
The Saudi war of aggression were largely supported logistical and politically as well, and even military and training, and then refueling even the air fighters' sorties in disguise of Yemen by the United States of America and other. Even nearly 80% of the equipment used in that aggression were supplied by the United States of America. And all the info and all the logistics as well. And 20% came from other countries like the United States, United Kingdom, France, Germany. Yemen lies in a very strategic position. This is controls the Arabian Sea and controls Bab al-Mandab, which enters the Red Sea, which is over 40% of the energy, which oil and gas goes to the world, and especially the West from there through the Suez Canal. We know anything comes from the Gulf states going in there. And we know as well why the United Arab Emirates went straight and occupied Aden and took over the port, not even to develop it, to make sure it will never function and work, and to make sure all the business stays in Jabal bin Ali and Dubai. In history, we know that the British used to run most of their empire from Aden, from India to Australia. It used to be Aden, which the third largest port in the world, which is give the British that immense control and power. So the United States of America today don't want to see an independent, sovereign Yemen state who doesn't obey the United States of America's orders or directions or its puppets in Saudi Arabia. So that's why they want to control Yemen, to make sure the whole strategic area is still under control of Zionist Western powers. And, and Saudi Arabia was acting in their behalf to further that agenda.
All right, so Hussein al-Bugheiti, tell us how much the U.S. interfered in Yemen's affairs, what kind of role and how much of a role it played, which was a destructive one when it came to Yemen.
I mean, it was clearly, as an example, in the first year of the war against Yemen, we remember that before Saudi or the so-called Hadi government has moved the central bank from Sana'a to Aden, Sana'a government at that time used to pay the salary like 2 years and a half after the start of the war till mid-2018. And then in some of the talks that was held in Muscat and in Oman, and there was as well the former U.S. ambassador to Yemen, he has actually at that time threatened the Sana'a delegation in Muscat that they will cut the salaries and as well they will move the central bank. And this is actually what happened since 2018. The Yemen income from gas and oil revenue has been sold out. The money actually Saudi is using that money in their war effort. They think that because there will be a pressure from Yemeni population against Saudi Arabia, especially not paying the salaries of Yemeni public sector. But what's happening actually is exactly the opposite. And this show you that the United States was actually planning from the beginning to stop those salaries. And as well, when the war was declared, it was declared from Washington by the ambassador of Saudi Arabia at that time. And it's really, really funny that a war is declared against a country, declare a war against another country from a third country. And soon after that declaration from Saudi ambassador in Washington, United States White House has released a statement saying that they will support that war against Yemen. And we've seen what the United States have actually done. They have struck the largest deal of weapon sales to Saudi Arabia and in the history of the United States to Saudi Arabia and United Arab Emirates during this war. And this actually shows that United States actually is well involved in this war. And if it was not to the United States, especially to the refueling planes that was refueling Saudi Arabia fighter jet across Yemen, Saudi Arabia actually will not be able to continue this war for more than a year. And this exactly shows that the United States is actually willing to divide Yemen. They are willing keep the situation in Yemen and the humanitarian disaster, one of the largest man-made disaster in the history of the world. And we've seen many outbreak of illness in Yemen. And I believe that if the Saudi Arabia actually, they might be actually willing to stop their war, because we've seen so many attacks against Saudi Arabia, but because actually the decision is in the hand of the United States.
All right, so you have this war that started, and many people forget, Sapshath, as our guests have reminded us, that it was actually announced by the U.S., which is quite unprecedented. And then as the war went on, you saw country after country dropping out of this war. There was a number of countries that were in support of this war and were part of the coalition. They continued to drop out until only Saudi Arabia and the UAE, along with the backing from the U.S., were left. But they weren't able to win the war. And they were so desperate at one point that even al-Qaeda, as a leader of Yemen's Ansarullah resistance movement, stated that the U.S. was using al-Qaeda terrorists not only to create divisions within Yemen, but to advance its agenda on the ground in order to beat the Ansarullah fighters, which they ultimately weren't. Why were they not able to beat the Ansarullah fighters, do you think?
Let's remember one fact, that when the Saudis used Takfiri groups, and the Americans engineered that actually for them on the ground, that's meant to get Yemen divided amongst tribes and amongst regions, so Yemenis can fight each other. And this is where they were bidden, as the Houthi himself said today. But Yemeni people, as we seen today when they were celebrating the 9th anniversary of the September 21st revolution, they showed a huge military parade in Al-Sab'een Square in Sana'a. During the parade, they displayed homemade vehicles, military boats loaded with heavy machine guns, drones, or range of missiles. This all made at home. And while flying in disguise, a war fighter jet and helicopters. That is muscles being flexed in the face of the Saudis. This is a victorious people who has developed their indigenous military industries. And as your guest alluded to, these weapons reach the heart of Saudi Arabia in Aramco, which is the nerve center of all life in Saudi Arabia, and reach United Arab Emirates, Abu Dhabi. So these two countries who's left in the coalition, they have interest One of them, the Emiratis, as I said, they wanted to control the south of Yemen with the help of the Zionist entity. And the Saudis is still under orders of the United States of America to stay the port in Yemen, because the Americans don't want Yemeni independent state sovereign who doesn't obey the orders of the United States of America to run that strategic country. Right. And the Saudis as well wanted to take a huge chunk from Yemen and its wealth as well.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Now we have enough reminiscing, I guess, about what was in the past. So now we're looking at what's happening currently. And it was in April, Hossein Abu-Ghaiti, roughly when we saw the ceasefires take place. And we now are in the phase of talks that are happening between the two sides. But what's interesting was that you had the U.S. Special Envoy for Yemen, his name Tim Lenderking, who was very pessimistic about these talks. I mean, he came out and said, quote, "I don't expect a durable resolution, and we should not, to the nearly eight-year conflict in Yemen, to happen overnight." And he said it wasn't something that's going to actually lead to any peace at this point. Some took that to mean that the U.S. did not want for peace to prevail, for there to be a deal. Why was the U.S., or why is the U.S., against a peace deal to happen?
Of course, we know that all United States policy in our region or in other areas across the world, it depends on chaos in those countries. As an example, one of the main reasons that the United States actually was interfering in Yemen even before the Saudi-United Arab Emirates coalition war is what they said, is because their goal is to fight, as they say, terrorism. But if they really wanted to stop that, they can see that Sana'a government actually they are willing to fight terrorists, and actually they have been succeeded in clearing all areas under the control of Sana'a government from all terrorists. But this is really clearly that the United States, as you mentioned, with their special envoy to Yemen, which have clearly made it that the United States is not expecting any peace from this talk, because they are actually the one who is in control. But the Saudi Arabia, if they really wanted an advice, they should actually look what is in their favor, what's in their advantage. Their economy is actually, and especially the oil refinery, is under threat from attack from Sana'a. That's why they should take a serious step to stop that. And that's why we've seen in the latest 2 to 3 weeks, in the last 2 months, the Saudi delegation has visited Sana'a, and as well, Sana'a delegation has visited Saudi Arabia. And I believe that this is because Saudi Arabia knows that there might be an imminent attack against Saudi Arabia, especially after the celebration of Prophet Muhammad. And I would just add one more thing.
Sure.
That Saudi Arabia, and they have the so-called Vision 2030. That's why Mohammed bin Salman, if he want actually to put that vision, which is actually started at the beginning of the war on Yemen, to change Saudi Arabia economy, he should actually consider that he must stop this war. And one final thing, we all remember that Saudi ambassador to the United States, who has actually declared this war, have said in an interview that this war was planned with the USA 6 months before the start of the first airstrike. And this is clearly shows United States' interest in keeping chaos in Yemen.
Sure. Well, you know, what's interesting here, Saab Shah, is this U.S. Special Envoy has also said that the preference here was for the war to actually continue, even as we speak. This is really the U.S. stance. And I want to ask from you, what he has stated is to advance the U.S. and Israeli anti-Iran crusade. Now, what is the deal there? I mean, is it because they want to keep Iran on check, or do they want to control this, as you mentioned, the Red Sea, the Gulf of Aden, and the Bab el-Mandab Strait, the significance and importance that that has? They want to control that, but they can't do it with Ansarullah movements in power. Is that the correct understanding or analysis there?
I really appreciate your question. It's a fantastic question. The United States of America invested heavily in this war and used all these puppets in the region to achieve, as I mentioned earlier on, to help Saudis to take a chunk, which is Hadramaut of Yemen, and to annex it. From Hadramaut, the Saudis plan to put an oil like a pipe to reach the Arabian Sea in there, which is will help Saudi Arabia to export 90% of its oil through that direction, which is a Strait of Hormuz will be absolute for the Saudis. And here with the United States of America's strategic plan is to stagnate Iran through the Strait of Hormuz. So the Saudis oil can go through Yemen, exported. The Emirates from Fujairah and that areas. So the only country will be in difficulties exporting its oil to the international market will be Iran. This is one major point in the whole of war on Yemen. And the other one is to make the Israeli regime is supreme in the region as they try to build bases in Socotra and taking control in the little islands near Bab el-Mandab so they can control all the trade and the movement, maritime movement in that area. So the whole thing is about hegemony and total control for the United States of America and Israel, and more besiege and stagnation for Iran.
Sure. Well, Hossein Boukhaiti, we find ourselves in a very interesting place when it comes to Saudi Arabia, because Saudi Arabia, as you are very well aware, its jewel, Aramco, was targeted by the Ansarullah movement, and they did it so well and on a number of occasions. Many have said that Saudi Arabia expected the U.S. Under the basis that Iran was supplying, which is false. Iran has said, we're not supplying any type of military equipment to the Ansarullah. But Saudi Arabia expected the U.S. to attack Iran. But when it saw that did not happen, hence we're looking now at a landscape where Saudi Arabia wants talks to reach some kind of conclusion. Is that a correct way of looking at it, given the fact that the U.S. doesn't want there to be a peace deal?
I mean, it could be right in some point, but Saudi Arabia, if they are really seeking some conclusion or result in stopping the war and stopping attack against Saudi Arabia, they know the only way, as Sana'a have said, is that the Saudi will stop further war effort against Yemen, will stop this aggression, lift the blockade, and withdraw all military personnel that they are not Yemeni, either from United States or United Arab Emirates. And we've seen that this so-called that weapons or Iran supplying weapons, I mean, Saudi Arabia has been closing the airport and the port for many, many years. I mean, they have been bombing a small fishing boat. It is hard, actually, to get medicine into Yemen, and they show you how false their claim that Yemen is actually getting weapons from Iran. But on the other hand, let's say what what they said is right. I mean, Yemen have the right to buy weapons from anywhere in the world to protect themselves. I mean, Saudi Arabia, they are not planting the F-16 or the Patriot or other military equipment in their field. They are actually buying those weapons directly from the United States, and they are getting direct help and direct support from United States and UK and other countries. But it has been clearly that actually the main goal or is actually behind this war is United States, UK, and Israel. We've seen that the United Arab Emirates is trying to separate Yemen. They are building bases in Bab al-Mandab Strait and as well in Socotra Island because I think that, and I'm sure that the United States knows that they cannot actually launch any war against Iran, or maybe there will be a future war or any clashes with China. That's why they want actually to secure the Red Sea. They don't want any country there that's anti-United States policy in the region.
Thank you for that. Last question to you, Sopshath, which I have to ask. You have 5 days of talks that have been reported to be very positive between the two sides. How much of a chance do you give these peace talks to actually yield results? In 1 minute, please.
I think the Saudis start to shift their position for the Yemenis' demands after the Oman mediator put more pressure on them because refusing the salary issue and the humanitarian issues for Yemenis, it means back to square one, which is back to war, which is the Yemeni Houthi movement promised massive escalation. And that is, if you go to square one, it means defeat to the Saudis. The other point which I want to make very clear in here, and I hope my friends in Yemen get it, the Saudis in their statement lately took a negotiation talking about themselves as a mediator. They are not the mediator, of course. They are the leading force of this war of aggression. But they're using this terminology to try to escape from reconstruction of Yemen and the course of legal and reparation for Yemenis. Okay. And the same thing. So the Saudis and the Americans have to be zoomed in for their responsibilities of
thank
the war
you.
In Yemen.
Thank you for that. Sopshath, author and West Asia expert from Belfast. Hossein Abukhiti, thank you. Activist and political commentator from Sana'a. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikhail Vitagwe and the team, it's goodbye.
From east to west, throughout the vast land of Iran, you're listening to IRIB English Radio. In the limelight.
Biden is seeking $40 billion in emergency funds for Ukraine and disaster relief. That total includes $13 billion in military aid to Ukraine, as well as billions of dollars more in funding to replenish a dwindling pot of federal disaster relief, according to two people with direct knowledge of the request. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. China Daily wrote, "The United States' flow of military and economic aid to Ukraine will rise by more than $20 billion if Congress approves a request that the White House made recently. The $20.3 billion, part of a larger $40 billion request, includes $13 billion in military aid for Ukraine in its conflict with Russia and $7.3 billion in economic and humanitarian assistance. It also includes $3.3 billion for infrastructure projects in regional countries impacted by the war. Since the start of the crisis in Eastern Europe in February 2022, the U.S. Congress has authorized $113 billion in overall funding related to Ukraine, If the new package is approved, that total will reach about $137 billion. The wider bill also includes money to counter China's Belt and Road Initiative, about $12 billion for natural disaster recovery in the U.S. and billions of dollars more to protect the U.S. southern border, along with funds to stem drug trafficking. The White House reportedly was expected to include aid to Taiwan to the bill, but that was not included. The $40 billion in funding will be in the form of an emergency supplemental package, a type of spending not limited by the debt ceiling deal reached between the White House and House Republicans in June. Shalonda Young, director of the White House's Office of Management and Budget, in a letter to House Speaker Kevin McCarthy, urged swift action on the U.S. commitment to Ukraine. A senior administration official told CNN, "We don't know how much longer this war is going to go on or how much more assistance we might need to support Ukraine. We won't be bashful about going back to Congress beyond the first quarter of next year if we feel like we need to do that." The Biden administration's request came after a poll from CNN found that 55% of Americans are against more spending on the conflict in Eastern Europe. Also, in the CNN poll, 51% said the U.S. already has done enough to help the Eastern European nation, which is not a member of NATO. Partisan cracks are emerging over the continuing funding to Ukraine, with support dropping among Republicans. The aid request sets up a potential battle with Republicans in Congress, some of whom have been skeptical over providing Ukraine any more money. McCarthy has said he doesn't support a blank check for Ukraine. After the debt ceiling deal passed, he said he wasn't prepared to support additional funding for Ukraine, arguing that it would be a violation of the deal. McCarthy said working on a supplemental right now is only blowing up the agreement. That's all about spending more money. So, no, I do not support a supplemental. 70 House Republicans voted in July on an amendment to the National Defense Authorization Act to strip Ukraine of all American military aid. The measure failed, but revealed substantial opposition. Representative Chip Roy of Texas, a member of the House Freedom Caucus that has often clashed with McCarthy, said this should be a non-starter for House GOP. It's time to stand up for Americans and against uniparity. There is a difference of opinion between House and Senate leadership on Ukraine funding. Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer and Senate GOP Leader Mitch McConnell both support continuing aid to Ukraine. McConnell, speaking in Louisville, Kentucky, recently said, "People think, increasingly it appears, that we shouldn't be doing this. Well, let me start by saying we haven't lost a single American in this war. Most of the money that we spend related to Ukraine is actually spent in the U.S. Replenishing weapons, more modern weapons, so it's actually employing people here and improving our own military for what may lie ahead." Mick Wallace, a member of the European Parliament from Ireland, wrote, "A lot of politicians and mainstream media are happy to continue supporting and fueling the U.S.-NATO proxy war in Ukraine. These are not the people dying in this stupid war. How much do these people really care about the working-class Ukrainians who are dying?" Also, Canadian journalist Aron Mate wrote, "Biden administration encouraged Ukraine to integrate into NATO and assault Donbas It refused to seriously address Russia's December 2021 proposals. After the crisis, it blocked a peace deal. It then pushed Ukraine into a counteroffensive it knew had no chance. Then it told Ukraine it won't join NATO anyway. Now it wants another $20.6 billion to prolong the war it provoked. Warren Davidson, a former Army Ranger, wrote, "Again, without a defined mission, how can we ever say mission accomplished? We can't keep sending aid without clear rationale for its intended purpose. And no, as long as it takes is not a sufficient answer." Also, according to Politico, Biden's emergency aid pitch will almost certainly cause additional angst on Capitol Hill. Where lawmakers face a tight timeline to avert a government shutdown by September 30. House conservatives have pushed for further cuts to government funding, already jeopardizing the passage of new spending bills before the White House's request for additional cash.
Comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
President Ibrahim Raisi says Iran has now grown into a country that can produce and export military hardware rather than just being an importer of weapons. Israeli forces have attacked Palestinian